local authority with more popular traditions. That memorable image of his face peering through the leaves of an oak tree, so familiar from the pub sign, probably derived some of its original power from Augustan Rome, and quite a lot more from the mysterious green man of British folk culture. The manly oak became something of a status symbol for owners of great estates, who prided themselves not just on my wife, my house, my horse, but also, it seems, my tree. In Jacob Strutt's illustrated book of Britain's grandest trees, almost half were oaks, who commanded respect not just on account of their magnificent stature, but even more important, their individuality. From the bull oak in Warwickshire, into which a large bull would habitually reverse and look out at the rain from inside the gnarled wooden cave, to the massive Calthorpe oak, whose curved outline and hollow trunk inspired the design of the Eddystone Lighthouse. Every tree had its own idiosyncrasies. Old oaks were individual, independent, and inclusive. Some served as alehouses, like Damery's Oak in Dorset. Others were gospel oaks, marking the spots where people stopped to offer prayers during the ceremony of beating the parish bounds. The Fairlop Oak was famous for its annual fair, where every stall and puppet show had to be pitched within the 300-foot circumference of its massive shade. Generous and capacious, the oak was big enough for everyone. And since many had been in the same spot for several hundred years, they were taken for granted for almost as long. But the cult of the oak was impelled by a realisation that the great trees might not be permanent after all. Oaks were in such short supply, in fact, that timber had to be imported from abroad. When war threatened, it was also crucial to defence. Oakwood was unique in its combination of hardness and toughness, making it much the best timber for shipbuilding. Even the twists of its branches provided shipwrights with the knee timber necessary for the curves and brackets of enormous boats. Since a large naval vessel required some 2,000 oaks, the depletion of the ancient oak forests was little short of a national disaster. Planting an oak tree became a national duty. The steady decimation of ancient British forests was impossible to reverse, however. And where once the land had been covered in mixed forests and grassland, by the 18th century, only 10% was still wooded. The growing popularity of the Robin Hood legend took place against the disappearance of much of Sherwood Forest. The Great Oak Cultivation Project had the added advantage of deflecting any lingering sense of internal division outwards to foreign enemies. In the patriotic anthem, Rule Britannia, the supposedly ancient, but in fact very newly created, nation of Britain is imagined rising more majestically with each foreign stroke, just as the severest storms serve but to root thy native oak. It's a stirring piece of political rhetoric, composed by two Scottish poets, but since it was first performed in 1740, only 5 years before the Jacobite Rising revealed deep divisions within both Scotland and England, the shining images of national unity seemed a little remote from lived experience. The oak's strong links to the Stuart monarchy, so carefully forged by Charles II, were deeply problematic for the new Hanoverian dynasty, who had arrived from Germany and whose connection to the royal family tree was via a rather less prominent branch. So the idea of an unspecific external enemy was highly expedient. But as a national tree, the oak was always a contested symbol, not least because of its well-established significance in Ireland, where many places acknowledged it in their names. Derry, the Irish for oak. The outspread arms of the oak offered a congenial symbol and make the complicated story of its political exploitation a telling example of how different notions of nationhood can be cultivated, felled, or replanted. If the same tree can inspire both conservative admiration for inheritance and radical enthusiasm for equal rights, as well as unionist pride in inclusiveness and separatist determination for independence, it's difficult to be too absolute about what the oak's real meaning might be. The celebrated toughness of oak wood, after all, embraced a sense of its flexibility and capacity for survival, which were just as important as its hardness. During the Napoleonic Wars, Nelson's great flagship, the oak-built HMS Victory, did much to secure the tree's permanent association with British liberty. And the link between oak trees and ships can still help us to a better understanding of the tree's enduring appeal. Although the oak's rootedness was so much admired, its metamorphic capacity was equally important. The unmoving oak carries an impulse to adventure, a desire to break free from roots, at once a genial, protective home lover. It is also a fearless explorer, pushing into the unknown and at one with the wind and waves. What is also evident from the Victory, though, is that oak, as a living material, is horribly subject to decay. Though now so well preserved in the dockyard at Portsmouth, the great ship experienced major repairs throughout its active life. In 1877, it nearly sank altogether because of rotting timbers. HMS Victory is at once a monument to an earlier era of national triumph and a reminder that the oak is not always as invincible as people might like to believe. Nor is it only the wood that's prone to disease. A major factor influencing the modern decline of the oak has been the disinclination of seedlings to grow in existing woods. This is what Oliver Rackham terms the oak change, a puzzling development probably caused by fungal disease or mildew, increasing the oakling's need for light. Far from being protective, the heavy canopy of a mature oak can be fatal to tiny seedlings struggling up through the rotting leftover leaves below. This modern adversity only adds to the perennial problems besetting acorns in the shape of hungry pigs, mice or squirrels, or the probability of seedlings being eaten by caterpillars abseiling down from the parent tree. With the even more recent phenomena of sudden oak death and acute oak decline, the future of the national tree seems far from assured. In the light of these misfortunes, the figures of our surviving ancient oaks take on a new dimension. Is the major oak in Sherwood Forest, its collapsing branches so carefully cradled by poles and wires, a heartening image of a caring community, or does it provoke less cheering ideas of a people clinging to memories of a great but increasingly vanished past? But perhaps the impulse to interpret trees as anything other than trees is one to handle with care. One of the most imaginative initiatives in contemporary tree culture has involved the felling of a 222-year-old oak tree on the Blenheim estate. The One Oak project is designed to show just how important an oak tree can be to people today. Wood from the felled oak has been made into furniture, jewellery, musical instruments, benches, beams, door frames, printing blocks, charcoal, firewood, sawdust for smokehouses, and wood chip for heating. It may be quite different from the old ideas of family trees or local gathering places, but it shows the oak's undiminished power to draw together the disparate and disconnected. Oak trees are not just part of the national heritage, for with proper management, they could be essential to the future. The Independent Panel on Forestry, commissioned to research the state of the nation's trees, recently concluded that woods have the potential to make an enormous contribution to the creation of a sustainable economy because of their capacity to lock up carbon, stabilise soil, protect areas subject to frequent flooding, improve air and water quality, and provide clean, renewable energy, not to mention nature reserves and vast recreational areas. And in this vision of a green and pleasant future, the oak has a central role to play. Not least because its timber is not only strong enough to replace steel girders and bricks, but also much better at retaining heat. Next time you're having a drink in the Royal Oak, then, it may be worth reflecting on the richly grained tables and low-hanging beams, wondering, perhaps, whether you're stepping into the past or into the future.
The Meaning of Trees. The Oak was written and read by Professor Fiona Stafford, and it was a Bona Broadcasting production for BBC Radio 3. Tomorrow it's the turn of The Willow, that's at 10:45 tomorrow evening. This is BBC Radio 3. We're broadcasting between 90 and 93 on FM, on digital radio. You can also listen to us live online in high-definition sound. 8 minutes past 11, now Late Junction with Verity Sharp. Thank you.
Seven of Scotland's finest musicians who collectively make up the group Session A9, and a set of reels there ending with one from the island of Bressay in Shetland. Great stuff. Session A9's latest release is self-titled, and it was one of the many releases that brightened up 2012. As was this, released just recently by Corinne Pulwart, who goes from strength to strength. She writes songs that always have a point, and they're full of observation and pathos, which is particularly the case here. This is a song written in memory of Susan Maxwell from Cornhill on Tweed in Northumberland, who was murdered when she was 11 by a serial killer. And Corinne writes, Susan's life was stolen from her in the summer of 1982 on her first solo walk home from a tennis club across the River Tweed in the Scottish Borders town of Coldstream. Whilst writing, I could hear the old Northumbrian lullaby, Felton Lonan, that captures the visceral fear and panic of losing a child.
Thank you.
From AU's 2012 release, Both Lights, that's a track called The Veil, following on from Corinne Poolwart's Half a Mile, and that's on her masterful album Traces. Do look out for her at the Folk Awards this year. She's up for Folk Singer of the Year, Best Album and Best Original Song. You're listening to Late Junction on BBC Radio 3, and here's a piece of electronica by Beijing's Daojun Yao called Words Without a Song, preceded by Murray Pariah playing one of Mendelssohn's Songs Without Words.
时间秒针滑下一秒摩擦一秒空间声音回响杂音雨声 更多杂音雨滴还有杂音水滴海底悬浮随意顿悟了悟悔悟 冰糖莲子 更多杂音，乌鸦、雪花，左右立体凝聚收缩爆裂几率反思眷恋燃烧腾滚倒立眼前模糊跳下阴暗散开强力飞逝好梦转身虚妄对应离开暂停雷雨树叶池塘抗拒
Thank you.
from an album called Borderlands, which is exploring connections between the music of China and that of Central Asia. That is Abdullah Majnun playing the long-necked dotar alongside the Chinese pipa player Wu Man and their version of a traditional tune which is said to have accompanied medieval kings from Central Asia into battle. That followed on from Da Jun Yao's Words Without a Song. Just going back to the notable releases of 2012, this too leapt out of the pile. Singer Stephanie Chladovsky and the guitarist Seajoins coming up with some refreshing takes on British folk songs on their album called The Wild Wild Berry. From it, this is The Pretty Ploughboy. That's the young Norwegian piano trio Moskus and a track called Farli Norsk Hengebru, which is on a debut recording they released back in January. And that following on from the voice of Stephanie Hladovsky. At last, we've got a full-length album from her, joined there by the guitarist C. Joins. And the album is called The Wild, Wild Berry. You're listening to Late Junction on BBC Radio 3 with me, Verity Sharp. And we'll have some blues from Jack Rose after this from the Western Sahara's Mariam Hassan.
La la la.
That's the late Jack Rose playing Knoxville Blues by Sam McGee. Details of anything that you've heard tonight and would like to get hold of will, of course, be on the playlist, which we post on the Late Junction page of the Radio 3 website. And, of course, if you'd like to hear anything again, you can do that if you use the Listen Again facility, and the programmes remain available for 7 days after broadcast. Now, I came across an album from Efren Lopez, Stelios Petrakis and Bijan Shemirani recently that had for some reason escaped my attention when it was released a couple of years ago. Something of a surprise, as I am a bit of a completist when it comes to their work. But I have it now, which is the main thing. It's an album called Mavra Fudia, which means black eyebrows. And I'll play you pieces from it which were inspired by the music of Greece after this from Shara Warden and Colin Stetson. It's their version of Lord, I Just Can't Keep From Crying Sometimes.
Thank you.
two pieces, one named after the ancient island of Saros, followed by a traditional Pano Horos, which is described as an up dance, and it's danced in the mountain villages of Karpathos, which is the second largest island of the Greek Dodecanese. Stelios Petrakis playing the lira, Efren Lopez the lute, and the percussionist Bijan Shemirani, all as impeccable as ever, and I'll play you more of this album tomorrow night. This is Late Junction on BBC Radio 3, and from the mountains of Greece to those of Tennessee.
Right this way, down to the Spotted Mountain Hideaway. All the girls lined up with spit in their eyes, kicking in a scratcher for a Tennessee prize. Gather round, boys, and place your bets. Which one of these cats can scratch the best? Oh, you gals want a good clean fight. Swanee Mountain Cat Fight's here tonight. Swanee Mountain Cat Fight, dollar and a dime. Girls going wild on the Tennessee line. Got her by the hair, another by the neck. Teeth all flying in a roadside shack. Well, the first thing you know, old Jump Off Joe took 12 to 1, win, place or show. Hannah took her horn and she was looking to kill, straight from the holler on Cat House Hill. Then the whistle blew, and Betty Lou took a hang in his hair and away she flew. Slapped her on the fanny, then she flipped her gown, racked up 4 points by the very first round. 20 mountain cat by dollar and a dime, girls gone wild on the Tennessee line. Got her by the hair, another by the neck, teeth all flying in a roadside shack. Door and the sheriff pulled out a 44. She wanna bring that hot ham home to you. Where the sheriff paid his $1.10. Said, boys, light up that fight again. Swanee Mountain Cat Fight, dollar and a dime. Girls gone wild on the Tennessee line. Got her by the hair, another by the neck. Teeth all flying in a roadside shack.
The Old Crow Medicine Show with the Suwannee Mountain Catfight. Great stuff. They're going to be coming to the UK early next year. They're playing at the Mandela Hall in Belfast on January the 31st, the Barrowland Ballroom in Glasgow on February the 1st, the HMV Ritz in Manchester on the 2nd, and then they're coming to the Shepherd's Bush Empire in London on the 4th of February. Do catch them if you can. And their latest album is called Carry Me Back. Just quietening things down a bit, here is Chris Byrne and a piece by Henry Cowell describing the music played by the mythical god Dagna, who was said to have played three harps for different purposes: laughter, sorrow, and in this case, sleep.
Thank you. this then.
Gareth Dixon and the first song on a new album released by the 12K label called Quite a Way Away. A song called Adrenaline, following on from Chris Byrne playing the sleep music of the Dagna by Henry Cowell. You're listening to Late Junction on BBC Radio 3 with me, Verity Sharp, and this is a piece born out of a late night jamming session between a couple of sax students at the University of Michigan in the late 1970s. It's a piece called Sax Sounds 3, or Diminishing Returns, by Stephen Gallant, played by Michael Duke. Thank you. Sax Sounds 3 by Stephen Gallant for two alto saxophones and electronic delay, played there by Michael Duke. Do drop us a line if you'd like the details. Our email address is late.junction@bbc.co.uk. You can, of course, write to us at BBC Broadcasting House, London W1A 1AA. And do send us any suggestions of things that you'd like to hear on the show too. I'm Verity Sharp, back tomorrow with Late Junction at 11. Till tomorrow, good night.
I'm John Shea. Welcome to Through the Night on BBC Radio 3. And if you love Czech music as much as I do, then stay tuned for the next couple of hours for a concert from the 2011 BBC Proms. The main work, played by the BBC Symphony Orchestra with their chief conductor Jiří Bělohlávek, is Smetana's complete cycle of symphonic poems celebrating his homeland, Mavlast. That's in 40 minutes, after we've heard one of the most intensely personal pieces that Dvořák ever wrote, inspired partly by his sister-in-law, who'd once been the love of his life, and who died soon after he returned home to Bohemia from America. It's his cello concerto in B minor. Jean-Guyen Queyras is the soloist.
Thank you. Thank you.